Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. Our speaker is Anne from Bernersville, New Jersey.
Hi, I'm Anne, and I'm an alcoholic. And just to qualify that, my home group is Bernersville, the Tuesday night Spiritual Awakenings group. But I actually live in Clinton, New Jersey, and I make most of my meetings these days in Ringo's. So Bernersville will always be my home group because that was the place that I first heard about the solution. I haven't really thought a lot about what I'm going to say, so I'm just going to start out, and hopefully I'll make some sense to somebody. But I do not come from an alcoholic family. There is no history of alcoholism in my family that I'm aware of. I think, knowing what I know now about the disease of alcoholism, that I was born alcoholic. The first time that I took a drink was a slumber party in seventh grade, and somebody's brother had got us a bottle of peppermint schnapps. We passed around once, and like, it's horrible. Passed around twice, and I'm like, this is not that bad. And by the third time that it came around to me, I was chugging the bottle. Now, they say about 10% of the population is alcoholic. And based on what I saw at the slumber party that night, it's probably true. There were maybe 10 or 15 girls, maybe 20, and everybody else had two or three sips, and they're like, I don't want any more. It's starting to feel funny, you know. They didn't want any more. And me and one other girl finished the bottle and went streaking and, you know, did all the things that really, really alcoholic people do. You know, woke up remorseful, was sick for the next 3 days. Knowing what I know now about alcohol, I probably had alcohol poisoning. I think I was 5'7" and 85 pounds. And I drank, you know, half of a fifth of peppermint schnapps. I don't like peppermint schnapps. I never did drink that again. So that was my first drink. Of course, at the time I knew absolutely nothing about the disease of alcohol or how alcohol affects the mind and body of the alcoholic differently than it affects the mind and body of other people. And I had no idea that there even was such a thing as an alcoholic. I just knew that, you know, grown-ups drank and that I wanted to be a grown-up real soon, you know. I drank, you know, on weekends whenever anybody had anything to drink, I drank again, and I used other substances. So I don't know if this is one of those groups that doesn't want you to mention other substances at all, but they are part of my story, and talk about it just enough because it's an important part of my story. So anyway, today, I drove out here. It couldn't be any darker. I saw the East Swamp Church because I made a wrong turn. I thought, oh, maybe Dave, who invited me, doesn't know his East from his West. Well, no. Maybe I'm in the wrong place. So I'm driving back around, and I see the Swamp Church. And I'm like, well, there can't possibly be room for an East Swamp, a Swamp, and a West Swamp. Something must be wrong. But I stayed on course and trusted the directions from MapQuest, and sure enough, here I am at the West Swamp Church, and I'm really happy to be here tonight. I was mentioning to a couple of the guys over here earlier that I frequently speak in front of groups, but that it's a captive audience, and that they're pretty hostile and very resistant to the idea that they may be addicts or alcoholics. So it's really nice to be here today, to be with a group of people who came voluntarily. I work in the women's prison in Clinton, New Jersey, and there's roughly 1,000 women there. Probably 85% of them have the disease of alcoholism or addiction. And we have a cottage with 60 women who we're doing treatment with. And idealistic me, I walked in there 2 years ago thinking, well, you know what? everyone is going to be so happy to see me, you know? Because, you know, they're in prison. They're clearly, you know, down and out, and they know they've got this disease, and they're going to want my help. Couldn't have been further from the truth. Most of the women that I work with are extremely resistant to the idea of treatment. And I guess, going back to myself, I wasn't so much resistant or in denial as delusional. As I told you, I started drinking at 12. And I really didn't think that I had a problem. I didn't think I had a problem when freshman year in high school, I failed absolutely every single class. And then I failed summer school, too. I didn't think I had a problem when I got kicked out of my regular high school, and I got kicked out of the Pennington school, and I got kicked out of the Solbury school. I really didn't think that I had a problem. The problem really was the rest of the world. You people just don't understand me. You know, I continued to not think I had a problem. By the time I was 16, I think I'd done 300 hits of acid, and I really didn't think that I had a problem. The problem was the rest of the world. You know, alcohol was like the stabilizer that kept everything going smoothly, but I really didn't think I had a problem when I did things like, when I was 17, I had been up for 9 days on another substance, and the last thing I remember was being at a party with a big bottle of wine, and I remember falling off the rock I was sitting on, and that's the last thing I remember. Now, the next thing I remember is I pick my head up, and I don't know if any of you have ever used other substances, if you've ever had that sensation that I don't know if I was asleep or not. And I like pick up my head, and I'm sitting in a circle of chairs, and there's this enormous sign that says, God is love. I'm like, oh man, I'm dead, right? So I'm pinching my elbow. You know, because you're supposed to pinch your elbow to tell whether you're alive or not. I'm pinching my elbow, I'm thinking, maybe I'm dead. Maybe this is like a waiting room or something, right? But as it turns out, it wasn't. It was just some church in the middle of nowhere that I had somehow, I have no idea to this day how I wound up in that church. But at the time, I didn't see that the sign was a sign that maybe, you know, God was trying to tell me something. I had a girlfriend when I was 16 who decided that she was an alcoholic, and because I was a wonderful friend who didn't have a problem, I would go to her AA meetings with her. And I looked up at the wall and that first step that said, admitted we were powerless and our lives had become unmanageable, was as far as I could get. I looked at that sign and I thought, well, that's really sweet for you poor, pathetic, powerless people. But I am the master of my own destiny. And I set off over the next 20-some years to prove that I was the master of my own destiny. And at times, I was delusional enough that I really thought that I was somehow in control. You know, that I knew what I was doing. And, the problem was the rest of the world. The problem was my parents. The problem is the cops in this town. The problem is that judge. But the problem isn't me. And it certainly it doesn't have anything to do with alcohol, you know. The other thing that I heard in the rooms of AA at that time was a lot of stories that I thought, well, you know, my story's not really good enough. I don't think I fit in. I'm not powerless. I don't believe in God. I can't possibly be here. And I didn't believe in God for most of my life. I was raised as a Unitarian, which is kind of a new agey, you can believe whatever you want to believe religion, which is cool, you know, that's what my parents are. And at the time, as a young child, I, in my brilliance, figured if you can believe whatever you want to believe, it must be because there's nothing to believe. And so, you know, again, I set off to be the master of my own destiny. Well, I guess it was 1992. I was living out in California. And I was married and had three young kids, and the man that I married was extremely abusive. And which is generally what happens when, you know, you're working as an exotic dancer and you marry the best friend of the bar manager and, you know, a.k.a. your crank connection, you know? But at the time, it really seemed like the perfect choice, you know? I mean, who else would I marry besides my connection, right? Because I don't have a problem. And it's funny, like, I had cycled through all those other substances, almost every other substance known to man, except for some of the new designer things that I'm, you know, not young enough to have tried. But I really thought, like, I don't have a problem. When that substance got to be too much, I just put it down. It took me, you know, years and years later and into recovery that, in retrospect, I realized that I was using one substance after another to detox myself. And alcohol, really, you can detox from almost anything with enough alcohol and marijuana. You know, it takes off the edge. You don't feel quite as sick. You know, I use one substance after another to detox myself. And alcohol was always there. I identify as an alcoholic primarily because alcohol was the first and alcohol was the last. And despite all the other things that I did, I believe alcohol is the most powerful drug in the universe. It was the thing that dealt the crushing blow that brought me to my knees. So going back to 1991, I'm in this abusive marriage, and I met these people who were into staying up all night reading the Bible. So I'm like, all right, you know, whatever. We're going to stay up all night, so we'll do whatever we do. So I started reading the Bible, and then things started happening. Like, I started thinking, entertaining the idea that maybe there was some kind of God. You know, that maybe I wasn't the master of the universe, the master of my own destiny, and that maybe there was something out there greater than myself. And the more that my mind and my heart opened to the possibility that maybe there was a God, the more violent my ex-husband got. And through a series of events, God moved in my life in a way so powerful that there was no denying it. I mean, things would happen like backing out of the driveway and I hear something fall from under my car, and I go in and I'm like, hey, Steve, you know, something's wrong with the car. He's like, I didn't do it. But, you know, it's like the fuel line falling from the front, which is supposed to happen when you're on the freeway. And we're out in the canyon country one night, and he's telling me, you know, there's 180 acres out here. Nobody's ever going to find your body. And something, I think, angel, God. I mean, I'm sitting there praying for the first time in my life, really believing that there is no other hope for me but God. And something picked him up and threw him across the room. I mean, and the next morning, we left safely. And about a week after that, we traded that car to someone. And a week after that, they came back and they said, you know, the brake lines were cut on that car. I gave it to my mother, and they were really mad. And I think what he was trying to do was scare me to the point that I would leave out of the canyons in the middle of the night. But God kept doing these things. And I started getting, like, messages from God. Like, and basically, you know, a whole lot of little things. But the message was, Ann, you got to get away from drugs and everyone who uses them. So I took my three little kids and what I could fit in a duffel bag and got on a Greyhound bus and headed back east to where my family was from in New Jersey. And, you know, at that point, and this is the point that I think I had what I now consider a partial spiritual awakening, because I got the message about the drugs, and God removed all obsession to use drugs. And I had been using since I was 12. I was 27. I'd been using a lot of different substances over a very long period of time. Got home, and I joined a church, and I got baptized. And I thought, well, there's no reason why a nice Christian lady who used to have a problem with drugs shouldn't have a glass of wine. I mean, after all, that's the first miracle that Jesus performed in Galilee, right? So, you know, so now I've created this separation between drugs and alcohol. And all the obsession to use drugs was completely removed from my life. I never touched street drugs again of any kind from that point forward. But interestingly enough, my glass of wine over the course of the next 8 years turned into a quart of tequila a day. And I drank and I drank and I drank and I drank. And in the height of my alcoholism, my kids were 5, 6, and 8, and the boys decided we'd been to a party at a roller rink, and they decided they wanted, you know, rollerblade skates for Christmas. And I said, you know, I don't know, guys, if we're really, I'm not going to spend $50 a piece on those rollerblade skates if it isn't something that you really like. So we went down to our rink, and we started taking rollerblade lessons. And, you know, parents were halfway, so I figured, why should I just sit there? So we started hanging around the roller rink a lot, and here I am in the absolute height of my alcoholism. Probably, you know, at that time consuming like the quart of tequila a day. And I decide, and because the boys want to do this, that we're all going to become speed skaters. Okay? Inline speed skaters. So I'm drinking a quart of tequila a day, and we get these skates. And I joined this team, and coincidentally, I guess, you know, they say coincidences are God's way of remaining anonymous. Coincidentally, the head coach of the speed skating team was the director of a substance abuse program. And the other coach had not had a drink in 30 years. So I joined this team. And it turns out that even as a totally wrecked alcoholic, that I'm really a pretty good speed skater. she must have been like a year or two into the speed skating thing that, I mean, I'm just falling apart. I went to my doctor shaking and crying, and I woke up every morning with shakes, and my doctor says, well, of course you're stressed out, honey. You have 3 little kids. You know, because this is what doctors do to women, especially women. I mean, he asked me, granted, he did ask me, did I drink? And I said, yeah, you know, I have 1 or 2, which was true. Because I had these big, like, 16-ounce glasses, and I'd get home from work, and I'd have 1. You know, of course, it's like that much tequila, and that much orange juice, and a splash of grenadine so that I can call it a mixed drink. That's a tequila sunrise. And I'd have that while I was cooking dinner, right? And then I'd have another one while we were eating dinner. And then after dinner, I'd maybe have another one. And, you know, those are big glass. You could probably, that's a quart of tequila, right? So I'm like, yeah, I have a couple. Which I saw my parents have a drink, you know. Really, my parents are not alcoholic. When I went to rehab, my parents cried. They're like, why are you doing this to us? They had no idea, because they are the average temperate drinker. When I got out of rehab, my mom said, well, you know, Annie, when you're 40, you can probably drink again. And she went on to tell me about how when she was in college, they had gone through a couple weeks where they had a few too many whiskey sours on Friday night, and they realized that was a problem and they stopped doing it. And, you know, and thus the reasoning behind, when I'm 40, I can probably drink again. And my father said, well, why don't you just do what I do? I just have 1. And he's serious. He was really, really serious. That's what my dad does. He has 1. And everybody in my family's like that. They're the absolute average temperate drinker. If they start getting tipsy, they're done. They don't want it anymore, right? I am the absolute raging alcoholic, and there isn't enough. Unless I'm anesthetized, there isn't enough. And it's remarkable how much tolerance a human body can build up over the course of years. Because, you know, a quart of tequila is a lot. I could drink a lot of men under the table back in the day. Except that I somehow intuitively knew not to leave my house when drinking. You know? And that's, like I tell myself, I'm a wonderful mother. You know, we did Little League, we did soccer, we did speed skating. And it wasn't until I came home that I consumed vast quantities of alcohol. Endlessly, you know, to the point where, like I said, I arrived at the doctor and I'm shaking and I'm crying. And he says, well, of course you're stressed out, honey. You have three little kids. Here's some Xanax. Everything's going to be fine. So it actually was fine for a little while because I took them in the morning and they're really, really good at getting rid of the shakes. So now my hands aren't shaking and I can type and I'm at work. And, you know, people at work were starting to say things like about how I smelled, you know, like they're like, are you drinking in the morning? I'm like, no. And I really wasn't, you know. I was just drinking so much at night that you could smell it coming out of my pores in the morning. But I was offended, you know. Those people suggested, and then the one lady sat down and told me some story about how her mother was an alcoholic, right? Like this is supposed to somehow convince me that I have a problem. But I was so deluded. And this is 1998, I guess. And I'm still so deluded. So deluded, I honestly didn't think I had a problem. I believed the doctor when he says, of course you're stressed out, honey, you have two little kids, or three little kids, it's three. You know, so now I'm taking the Xanax in the morning and going to work and then consuming my quart of tequila at the end of the day and throwing a couple more Xanax over on top so I can sleep, right? Because that's the kind of alcoholic that I am. And, you know, Christmas time that year, I wrecked my car. But, you know, my lawyer told me, it's Christmas time. And lots of people have accidents leaving Christmas parties and stuff. So, but yeah, you know, lots of people have accidents around Christmas time. It doesn't necessarily mean that I have a problem with alcohol. You know, it just means that I wrecked my car, which is unfortunate, but, and they took my license for 6 months, because that's what they do in New Jersey when you have a drunk driving, and I was going to plead not guilty, you know, and try and go, like, the breathalyzer, something was wrong with the breathalyzer, and then I saw the videotape that they made of me when they brought me in. And I'd always thought, like nobody can really tell when I'm drinking, you know? Like, I have a very high tolerance, and nobody can really tell when I'm drinking. And then here's this videotape, and I'm like, are you going to hold my hand? To the officer, and I'm laughing. And you know, like, I really thought I was cute. I wasn't that cute. And I began, after seeing that video, to get this slate inkling that maybe I had a problem with alcohol. And let's see, what happened next? Yeah, and I started to think, maybe it is the alcohol. And then I started doing things that I wished I hadn't done, like driving all the way to Atlantic City with my three kids in my minivan, drunk out of my mind for a speed skating race. And, you know, and again, like I said, my coaches are both sober. One is sober and the executive director of a program. The other one was 30 years sober because alcohol had been a problem in his life. And I'm like visibly drunk. I'm visibly drunk the next morning. And I'm starting to feel like, oh my God, what sort of person am I? I got in my car with my kids blind drunk. Blind drunk, like I have no idea how I made it there. And I drove all the way to Atlantic City with my kids in the car. And then I started thinking, like, maybe that wasn't the first time that I drove drunk with my kids in the car. And little by little, it's the idea, you know, things like at the party where you end up in the hot tub and everybody on the speed team finds out about it because it was at another team member's house, and it's like everybody's like looking at you like, oh my God, I can't believe, you know, she doesn't know she has a problem with alcohol. And it began to become apparent that I had a problem with alcohol. And I started going to AA meetings. And I went to AA meetings, and I could not stop drinking. I went to AA meetings for a whole year, and people told me, well, listen, you got to stay on 1, 2, and 3 for the first year. And I'd be like, you know, I'm pretty sure I got the step one. I know I'm powerless and that my life is unmanageable. You know, I can't stop drinking. And every other day I was in the meeting and I raised my hand and I said, I drank again. People said things to me like, well, you got to put the plug in the jug, you know. Just don't drink no matter what. And I couldn't stop drinking. And I drank every day, and I drank every night, and it got to the point where I was unemployable, and I went to detox. And I got out of detox, and I drank. And I drank. And still, people in the area where I was going at the time kept saying, you know, well, whatever you do, don't do a fourth step. You know? Whatever you do, don't do a fourth step. That's dangerous. It'll take you out. And I'd go to meetings and I'd be like, you know, I know I got step one. And I know I got step two because like I told you before, you know, like God had removed all the obsession to use drugs like 10 years earlier. All obsession removed completely. I'm like, I know I got step two. I know I have God in my life and that God can remove this. I know that this is true. And step three, I was absolutely willing. I was willing, like, during that 6-month period when I didn't have my license, I used to ride my bike around town. And I ride my bike to AA meetings. And I got hit by a car riding my bike to the hospital meeting. And, of course, I got back on my bike and rode to the meeting, right? And one time, I mean, I guess, like, you can imagine the area because there's some winding back country roads here. I decide that I'm going to, I can't get a ride to the Friday noontime meeting at the Grandin Church in Clinton. And at the time, I'm living in Flemington. So I'm like, all right, nobody's going to give me a ride. And I put on my speed skates, inline speed skates, don't have brakes because we're not worried about stopping. We're just worried about going fast. So I put on my speed skates and I skate from Flemington up Thatcher's Hill and down these back winding roads. It's like a 20-mile ride from Flemington to Clinton, the back way. And I'm like, I don't know if you've ever been by the Walmart in Clinton, New Jersey, and then the Grandin Church is like down this big hill. So I'm tucked like a skier trying to, because my wheels are wobbling. I'm going 55 miles per hour down this hill, and there's cars on the left and a field on the right. And I'm like, man, if I wipe out, I hope I go in the field, right? So as far as like, you gotta want it, I wanted it, man. I wanted it so bad. But you know what? Step one says that I'm powerless. And my life is unmanageable. And so no amount of Anne wanting to get sober is enough to make Anne get sober. That's where, you know, step two has got to come in. You know, I got to believe that there's a power that can remove my alcoholism. And then step three, you know, I have to be willing to do whatever it takes. And this is where people had been stopping me. And don't go past step three no matter what you do. You'll get drunk, you know. Fortunately, you know, during the time that I'm making meetings, people did a lot of the right things, you know, like a lot of women put their hands out, a lot of women gave me their phone numbers. So I arrive in detox for the second time, and they're going to let me out. I'm like, no, I really think I need some help. The people from my speed skating team volunteered to watch my kids for 30 days so that I could go to rehab. But I was making $10 an hour, and I didn't have any benefits. So the state of New Jersey says I'm not indigent, I can't go to rehab. So I'm like, oh man, they're kicking me loose. I know I can't stop drinking. I know I'm going to drink again. And that's the point where, like, I really feel like God moved in me in a way that I became more willing. Because I'd been willing before, as willing as, you know, only the dying can be. And at that point, I'm on what they call the flight deck. It's the 5th floor in the hospital in Flemington. I'm in detox and they're going to kick me loose. And I get on the phone, my little pocket full of numbers, and I start calling people. And coincidentally, which I like to think of coincidence as like God's way of remaining anonymous. So coincidentally, one of the women that I call says, well, you know, my mother-in-law was in this place called the Honesty House. The Honesty House used to be in Sterling, New Jersey. And guy Charlie Stuckey was the guy who was there for me. He was running it at the time. So let me make a phone call to my mother-in-law and see what she can do. So she calls her mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law calls the Honesty House. And the Honesty House agrees to take me for 30 days on a full scholarship. I paid absolutely nothing for a 30-day course of treatment. And they fed me and they housed me. And they brought in meetings from the outside. And we had groups. And the one meeting on Thursday night was from Bernardsville, from the Tuesday night Spiritual Awakenings group. And they brought in this meeting, and they start talking about the solution. And I'm like, leaning forward. I'm like, there's a solution? There's a solution? Wait a minute. And then they start telling me that the big book, the Alcoholics Anonymous book, is the basic text of our program. And that in that book, in the first 164 pages, there are directions that tell you how to work the steps. Because I've been going to these step meetings where people would, read a piece out of the step book, and then they'd share about some unrelated topic. And, I feel really crummy because my dog's not feeling well today. And then the next person would read the next paragraph and share about some topic also not related to the step book and not related to what the first person said. And it would go on like this, and I'd be like, oh my God, I'm the, what do we call him? The incapable, constitutionally incapable. I'm that one. I'm the one who is so dishonest that I just can't get this program. I'm the one who's so full of crap that I just can't do this thing. And in a way, it was true. And I believe we all are coming in. We all are. In my life, in my experience, it was the fourth step, third and fourth columns of the fourth step were the first time I'd seen any truth in my entire life. I was that constitutionally incapable of being honest. I absolutely was, because I only saw life through my own distorted view. I saw life as the hopelessly alcoholic sees it. I saw life as the warped, twisted, sick friend sees it. And I only saw it that way. And up until the point where I got into my fourth step, I was incapable of seeing life any other way than how I saw it. And the first day that the Bernardsville group brought that meeting in, after the meeting, a woman walked up to me and she said, "Do you have a sponsor?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, then I am your temporary sponsor." And that was Nancy. And Nancy was my temporary sponsor for the next 3 years. Nancy came every Saturday while I was in the Honesty House. And when I told her the same thing I'd been telling the other people about how, I knew I had steps 1, 2, and 3. I knew I had it. She's like, "Well, I guess you could need to do step 4. So immediately she started coming up on Saturdays and helping me through the fourth step. And the number one person on my fourth step was me, because I had, by the time I actually graduated high school, I was going to a really nice alternative school, for really, really, really messed up kids. And one of the things that they taught me there at that school was about accountability, about taking personal responsibility. And I really think that that school, the Hunterdon Learning Center, really helped save my life too, because if I hadn't gotten that piece, I would have had a lot more resentments, and I never could have got through that fourth step with so much work anyway. So did this fourth step, and I listed all the people that I was resentful at, all the institutions, all the ideas that I hated and I was angry about, and then, you know, what they did to me. And in the third column, I looked at, you know, how was I affected? What parts of self were hurt? You know, was it my self-esteem, my ambitions, my pocketbook, my personal relationships, my sexual relationships? And I looked at all those different parts of self. And I came to understand how I'd been affected by all the things that had been happening throughout the course of my life. And in the fourth column, I looked at the truth for the very first time in my life. And I took a look at, you know, where am I selfish? Where am I self-seeking? Where am I dishonest? And where am I afraid? And it turns out that almost everything that I blamed everybody else for, I had a part in. You know, in almost everything. And including the things that I hated myself for, because those were the most significant. And I don't know how it is for the male alcoholic, but as a woman alcoholic, I had a lot of shame, a lot of guilt, a lot of remorse. You know, as a mother, as a daughter, as, you know, just a woman, I had made every ugly mistake that a woman could possibly make. And I had a lot of self-loathing attached to that. And when I looked at the fourth column of all the things that I hated myself for, you know, the opportunities that I had missed and the people I had hurt and embarrassing my parents and my brothers and, you know, endlessly on and on and on and on. It was again and again and again, the pattern revealed that, you know, where was I dishonest? I was dishonest in thinking that somebody as sick as me could have done anything else than what I did. That all the mistakes that I made as an active alcoholic, I had to stop hating myself for, because that wasn't me, that was the disease of alcoholism. And because my sponsor came up and worked with me, you know, when we sat together and we worked through the entire fourth step while I was in rehab, it was like doing a fourth and fifth step. The week that I got out, I went to her house and we did the formal fifth step. And and the, you know, the big book promises that after the fifth step, we'll be able to look the world in the eye again. And for me, that was true. And one of the things that kept me out the longest, that kept me sick, that kept me delusional, was, you know, shame. That inability to look the world in the eye. And a lot of that resided in me even before I picked up, that uncomfortability, that awkwardness, that I'm different, that all the little kids are having fun together and I'm weird. You know, the everybody knows how to play hopscotch except for me, or everybody can do everything except for me. I'm different than you. I'm different than you. I'm different than you. And I had felt that way my entire life. You know, and it wasn't until I picked up a drink that I found a solution to that problem. That problem that those of us who are in recovery recognize as the spiritual malady. They say there are three parts to the disease, and that it's physical, it's mental, and it's spiritual. And the physical part they removed from me when I went to detox. And if it were just that simple, I wouldn't have picked up and drank again. Now, the mental obsession went on way longer than that. And people say sometimes, like, bring the body and the mind will follow. Well, the Burnsville folks believe exactly the opposite, which is, you know, treat the spirit and the mind will heal and then the body will finally come along afterwards. But for me, I just thank God that, like, I landed in a place where I landed, where people were working the program out of the big book, because I don't think anything else would have worked for me. I'd spent a year, like, wanting it, really wanting it, and doing whatever it takes to show up at meetings and not being able to get sober. But after we did that fifth step, I could look the world in the eye again, and I wasn't so ashamed, and I didn't hate myself quite so much. And, you know, six and seven have me get ready. If I've done the first five steps correctly, and the sixth step is a no-brainer, I'm ready to have God remove all my defects of character. And in the seventh step, I don't have to do anything except for, you know, let God remove them. Because sometimes, like, I'm not really smart enough to know what's a defect and what's an asset. I'm still human, and I'm still, like, looking at the world through my own eyes. And I used to think things like self-sufficiency we're assets, you know. And the program tells me otherwise. You know, self-sufficiency will kill me. The idea that I got this, I can do it all by myself, and I don't need your help will kill me. You know, the world tells us a lot of things as we're young children growing up, like, you know, don't ask anybody for help. Don't tell anybody about your problems. A lot of things which would have killed me. So I feel really, really grateful that God has removed enough things from my life to keep me sober for as long as he has. And the 5th of this month was my 10-year anniversary. So, and trust me, it is not like something I did that brought this to be. It was just like, early on, I listened to people. When they started talking about the solution and pointing it out where it was to me, when I got to the 8th step, it was easy because I'd already done all that work in the 4th. When I got to the 9th step, my sponsor helped me arrange these little note cards. She started with the easiest ones to the hardest ones, and she had me go out and do every single one of them. You know, the easiest ones first, the hardest ones last. And I made a lot of amends, a lot of amends. I made amends to people who had hurt me more than I hurt them, but I never mentioned what they had done to me, because that's not my part. My part is cleaning up my side of the street. One of the amends that I made was to my oldest son's father for having not really let him be involved in Matthew's life. And the miracle in that was not what I thought it was, which is, you know, oh, we're supposed to get back together again, which actually didn't work out. But he's, I found him in a prison in Philadelphia and made my amends. We tried to get back together and it didn't work out. But this is a man who had a 40-bag-a-day habit, who had been using his 40-something, and he'd been using since he was 12, and he's sober today, 7 years. So the miracle is like how we affect the lives of others. And I have to always remember to try and remove myself from the equation, because still, even at however much time sober, I'm still naturally selfish and naturally self-centered, and I have to be really, really careful to not get what Ann wants confused with what God wants. There's a guy up in, who used to come around to Burnersville, who used to say, what I want doesn't matter, Dave. And when Dave said, what I want doesn't matter, it was like a litmus test for me. I could tell if I was in a good place spiritually when I'd be like, yeah, you know what, I know what Dave means. What I want doesn't matter, right? Or if I was in a really bad place, well, I'd be like, well, you know what, it matters to me. My God cares what I want. You know, my God cares what I want. You know, it's my personal God, and he cares about me. So I can always tell, like, if I'm in a good place or not, if what I want doesn't matter, makes sense to me. Because today, like, what I want really doesn't matter. It's not going to affect the overall outcomes. Today, I try to be... one of the other things that somebody told me early on was that the program has three sides, you know, unity, service, and recovery. And if you think about those three sides like a three-legged stool, and you remember that in order to sit on your stool, each of those legs needs to be the same length, then you'll always be safe. So it's the unity, the service, and recovery in equal portion, because I can't do all of one and none of the other. And I can't do, you know, well, I'm really good at this, so I'm not going to do so much of that. To remember that, you know, it's a three-part disease and it's a three-part solution. And that if I want to stay well, I have to do all those things. For me, the recovery work is easy. Like, I like dissecting everything and writing it down on paper and doing all that. And the service work is easy. 2 years ago, I started working at the women's prison in Clinton, so I get in 40 hours of service work every week, and I get paid for it. And I really, really love these women. And you can see, like, places where it'll start to make sense to them. And, like, it's a perfect illustration of doing the work and trusting the outcomes. Because these are women who, for the most part, I don't know, they say they don't want to be there, you know, but then see something else at times. But you know, so I do that work. And the hardest part for me, really, is the unity part. Like, I'm not great at socializing. I'm not great at fellowship. I really need to polish up my fellowship. I'm not good at, you know, just going out with a group of people or letting people get really close to me is hard for me. And I kind of, like, keep people out here and I say, you know, why isn't anybody close to me? Why isn't anybody getting really close to me? And, you know, but I'm keeping you at arm's length. And so that's something that I'm working on this year. The other thing that I'm really working on is kind of making financial amends to myself. A year sober, I bought a house. And which is funny, and it's another kind of God thing, because trust me, I had not carefully planned for my financial future. You know, like how Social Security sends you that paper every year that shows like how much you earned this year and how much you're going to get from Social Security and how much you earned every year of your life since you got your first job. I have like a decade of zeros, right? A decade of zeros. Then there's the year that I made like $900 and a couple years where I made like $4,000. And then like the next year, they gave me a mortgage, right? A 30-year fixed rate mortgage at under 6%. And I'm telling you, it wasn't me. That was like God working in my life. And it took a lot of courage, like, to step outside of my comfort zone, because like I said, I have three children. Now they're all grown up. They're 19, 20, and 22. But throughout the course of the last 10 years that I've remained sober, I promise you, these boys have put me through every kind of hell imaginable. And I'm not sober by the grace of Anne. I am sober by the grace of God. Because, you know, we've been through, like, car accidents and rehabs. And one of my children does not have this disease. One of my children is so good that I swear to God he must have been switched at birth. He's like all pro-social, never got in trouble in school, never did anything wrong, never been in a fight. And then there's my oldest son who is kind of iffy. Like he probably has it, but he's pretty slick about it, so he always comes up looking pretty good. And then there's my youngest son, which, by the way, please, if you've never had any children, don't name one of your children after a bottle of whiskey. My son, my youngest son is Jack Daniel, first and middle name. And I won't give away his last name because you'll recognize him when you see him. He's 19 years old, and he's like, you know, a hellraiser. He's just a hellraiser. I don't know where he got that. I have no idea where he got that. But, like, you know, my ability to stay sober for the last 10 years had nothing to do with me being strong or me being great or, you know, had some really, really painful things. One of the worst things that happened was this past year, a girlfriend of mine who had, like, 6 months less than me picked up again. And, like, that was probably the most painful thing that I went through. But I, you know, regrouped and tried to make more meetings and stick close with my sponsor. And I just really believe, like it's not me that keeps me sober. I really had, the longer I stay sober, the more I realized, the less I had to do with it, you know. I just kind of happened to be there when God was there to help. And what, like, the steps for me, it's kind of like God was there the whole time with his hand outstretched, his, her, it, you know, whichever name we each have for a higher power, was there the whole time with hand outstretched. And I could see it, you know. I could see that God was reaching out to me, but it wasn't until I worked through the steps of the program that I could actually put my hand in the hand of my higher power. And I really had to, you know, do what the program says, which is clear away the wreckage of my past, because the only thing that stands between me today and a drink is my higher power. Nothing that I can do as a human being can ensure that I will remain sober. It's a daily reprieve, and it's based on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. So I do a lot of prayer and meditation, do a lot of service work. I try to stay close to as many women in the program as I can. And I try and work on myself and look at the truth about how almost everything that goes wrong is just like the stuff that I keep having to stick my finger in, you know. All the stuff that goes right is where I'm like, well, you know, if life is like a stream, I need to just like get on my inner tube and kick back and enjoy the ride and stop trying to swim upstream all the time, you know. But I'm stubborn, I'm self-centered, I'm selfish, I'm alcoholic. But I'm sober, and I really, really appreciate being asked to come out here. I don't do a lot of speaking. It's one of the things that I probably don't do enough of, is telling my story. So I'm grateful for having had an opportunity to do that today at the West Swamp Church. And if there's anybody who's headed out towards 309, maybe I could follow some money, because I'm not real sure of how to get back to civilization. Not that Clinton, New Jersey is a big city or anything, but I guess that's about it. There's like five more minutes, but I can't think of anything else to say. So.